You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Screens of the Stone Age, the podcast where scientists review movies about prehistoric people. I'm Joshua Lindell. Oh, I'm Dr. Joshua Lindell. paleoanthropologist studying Neanderthals. And I'm here with...
I'm Dr. Kimberly Plomp. I am a bioarchaeologist. I study the human skeleton, health and disease, and evolution.
And I'm Dr. Ross Barnett. I'm Dr. Ross Barnett, studier of paleogenetics, ancient DNA, and Pleistocene megafauna.
We know who we are and what we're doing.
Even if no one else does.
Yeah. Today we're reviewing a movie called Teenage Caveman from 1958. I think we're going to say at the top of this one, we always spoil the movie. We're going to spoil this movie for sure, but this movie's got a twist in it. So if
this
you don't want it to be spoiled,
me.
You should stop now.
Yeah. I did not see this twist happening. Like I was like, whoa.
Oh
yeah.
My God.
If you don't want this to be spoiled, stop listening to this. Go watch the movie. It's free on YouTube. We'll put the link in the description. Watch the movie and then come back and we'll talk about it.
It's only an hour long.
It's 65 minutes long. It's a really short movie.
It's much shorter if you watch it at 1.5 times speed as well.
Which you can do on YouTube.
Without missing anything.
So you've had fair warning. Now, the thing about this movie is I was just looking up. There's a remake of it. I assume it's a remake from 2002.
Really?
And in that one... Yeah, in that one, there's no twist. Oh. They're just not cavemen. They're just people living in a post-apocalyptic world. And I don't know why. Like, they start off and it's clear that they're just living in a post-apocalyptic wasteland.
I mean, that's a different
movie.
So
that's the twist to this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's spiritually the same movie because they're in a post-apocalyptic future where the world has been bombed and... people have reverted to their Stone Age ways, which is the twist to this movie. They're not cavemen. It's the future. It's not the past, which was a pretty good twist. If I researched the movies ahead of time, so I, you know, spoiled it for myself going in before I watched it. But
I think they spoil it for themselves as well, because I was reading before I watched it, one of the taglines for the film was about how it's in a post-apocalyptic world. So it's like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Oh, that's the tagline on IMDb.
Yeah, I didn't
on
read
IMDb,
that.
The tagline says, nuclear holocaust has destroyed the world as we know it, and now the future of humanity is in the hands of teenage caveman. But that can't be the real tagline for the movie, because if you look at the posters, it's just a caveman and a cavewoman fighting a dinosaur. So yeah. I don't think that's the real tagline for this movie when it was released.
But there isn't actually any scene of them fighting a dinosaur in the film. So
no, there's not. They don't. There are dinosaurs, but they don't actually fight them.
Well, kind of. when I saw Teenage Caveman, I was like, okay, so it's going to be like a goofy, like that one with Ringo Starr in it, right? Like I thought it was going to be a goofy Teenage Caveman. And then I thought it was from 1958. So then I thought it was going to be like, Teenage Caveman. And then it was so serious. Like, even the, like, dramatic lines were just said in, like, a really monotone. He took us and there was great beasts and they battled and we watched and someone died. Who died? The blonde guy.
Yeah. He doesn't deserve a name.
No, yeah, like, it's such a small tribe and they're like, I don't know his name. I never caught his name. Known him since birth.
I thought they didn't have names. They just describe each other
as
like
the blonde guy.
The blonde one. The son of the symbol maker. The symbol maker.
Yeah,
right?
I guess so.
Does somebody want to summarize this movie?
Yes, I can do that. I took plentiful notes.
Okay.
All right. So, as Kim says, this is a very serious film about serious things with serious actors. And there's a very serious voiceover at the beginning, which was kind of quite disconcerting. It has like a, essentially it's a paraphrase of Genesis about how in the beginning there was chaos. And then caveman And we see the teenage caveman, who's Robert Vaughn, the man from Uncle, which is pretty cool. That's quite a big name.
But he's like 35 in this. It's a Roger Corman film.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. In the tradition of, you know, American teenage films, he's at least in his 30s and looks it. I mean, this is a man that's lived a life. He's Brill Cream to the hilt. He's got like a very 50s heartthrob haircut. And, you know, you can tell that he kind of chases dames and smokes like a chimney. But yeah, there's some great names that come up in the credits. So it's a Roger Corman film. So obviously legendary Roger Corman. Beach Dickerson, which I think must be one of the best names for an actor ever. And yeah, you can take some topping for that. So anyway, you see a bunch of cave men. It's all men. The women don't get to do very much. It definitely does not pass the Bechdel test. But they're all returning from a hunt. At first, I thought it was going to be just a kind of grunting caveman language, because that's what they do at first. But then the symbol maker, he starts to speak English. So this is a film where the cave people speak English, which makes it, I think, a lot better just from that. And then we find out that these guys love rules and laws. They have so many rules and laws. Teenage caveman Robert Vaughn wants to go beyond the river, which kind of is the boundary of the tribe's kind of sort of territory. But that's forbidden, as is pretty much anything and everything to this tribe. Everything is forbidden, and it's against the law. And these are a kind of non-literate people, but they have so many laws that it's just unreal.
It was like the prehistoric Footloose, right? Town, right? Like everything, nothing is allowed.
It's just everything's forbidden. But beyond the river, they've got lizard dinosaurs. We see them. It's like a baby crocodile or some kind of reptile with a bit of plastic sail glued to its back. And they put it up against the monitor lizard. And again, you know, don't watch this if you're squeamish about animal cruelty. But we've
seen this scene before, right?
I thought so.
The scene was in the original 1 million BC, the 1940 version.
Right.
And it's much longer in that version. In that version, we watched that monitor lizard bleed out.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
so they've cut it short, which is nice, but we do get the alligator death roll on it in this movie.
Yeah. And one of the things I first noticed, one of the things I made notes of, is as we see them kind of going to the other side of the river, Robert Vaughn's got a metal spear, which maybe is a bit of foreshadowing that this isn't exactly the Stone Age, that he has a metal spear with a metal point. So that was quite interesting. Anyway, if they're back at the cave. We see that all the cave ladies love teenage caveman. He has some, I think Riz is what the kids these days call it with the cave women. And we see like, there's so much kind of exposition. After about 8 minutes, I put it on to 1.5 times speed because it was so slow. One of the things they have is three guys who just sit in front of the cave, who it seems their entire job for their whole life is to guard the gifts of men, which is fire, wheels, and clay. So there's a guy that just tends to a tiny fire. That's his whole purpose in life. There's a guy that just spins a wheel. He's like an early DJ. He just spins that wheel round and around. and there's a guy that just makes stuff out of clay and then breaks it. I mean, their whole life is to set up like a kind of visual metaphor. So, that's interesting. But we see pretty quickly on that there's one member of the tribe who has a beard and is therefore evil. We know that. But he's setting up Robert Vaughn. He's kind of being like the serpent whispering in his ears about, you know, if I didn't have a dodgy leg, I'd be over there exploring stuff, breaking the laws, being a rebel, being a teenage rebel. But you know, we see later on that was all horseshit. That he was perfectly capable of going over to the beyond the river, but he just was trying to set up teenage caveman, our hero. So the teenage caveman Robert Vaughn and his dad, who is the symbol maker, they're trying to organize another hunt. And so in this film, we see that their explanation for cave art is a sympathetic magic. So Robert Vaughn's dad and Robert Vaughn go into the cave to paint on the walls to bring a successful hunt. And then they go off to hunt. and they have rattles as kind of noisemakers to kind of flush out the prey as they're going along. They are kind of, let's see, oh, I'm getting confused now. Oh, yes.
This is where they get into the fight with the bear rug, the bear skin rug.
A bear, there's a bear attack during the hunt, and it is very, very obviously a man in a bear suit. I mean, that has to be on our cave person bingo now. There's been quite a few films that have just been a guy in a bear suit, not even trying to act very bear-like. But he kills... No, he doesn't kill. He attacks Robert Vaughn's dad and injures him. So they have to come back, and the symbol maker is now quite badly damaged and has to get some medicine. But Robert Vaughn, in the meantime, is forming his own kind of teenage posse, this teenage gang. And you can really see the kind of fears of the 50s parents' generations about, you know, there's lots of kind of worries coming through about gangs and rebelling against the rules and going your own way, all that kind of stuff that the sort of beatnik generation were all about. Anyway, Robert Vaughn gets together his posse of other kind of rebellious teens, and they're going to go over to the forbidden part, past the river, and they're worried about being eaten by the earth, which we kind of realize pretty quickly is quicksand. It's another bingo tile right there. And of course, immediately the blonde guy gets swallowed by the quicksand.
But in the most anticlimactic way possible. Like, it was so slow. Yeah. Everybody was moving so slowly to rescue him. No one seemed panicked whatsoever. And then when he was gone, they were like,
oh, well.
Oh, well.
Which one was he again? Oh, yeah, the blonde one.
The blonde one.
I mean, it was even slow at like 1.5 times sped up. So God knows what it's like at normal speed. And Robert Vaughn doesn't even seem particularly bothered by this.
No, I think, none of them are.
He is a bit of a sociopath. but I think at this point, the others kind of abandoned him and he goes off. He's hunting squirrels. So he kind of finds some squirrels or chipmunks or something. And we see some more of the scary animals live in the beyond. So there's an armadillo that's pretty scary. So a snake and some people in rubber T-Rex outfits, which are hilarious. They're just kind of wandering randomly in some forest. And then a rubber monster attacks them. And it looks, I mean, we've seen some pretty dud costumes for monsters over the past few years, but this one's pretty bad.
It's like a swamp monster and a mosquito had a baby.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And it's got like a little trunk. It's not even a kind of very useful trunk. Anyway, that becomes clear later on.
Well, that costume was recycled from a previous movie, which is why it doesn't make any sense in this movie.
I feel like a lot of it was recycled. Anyway, so Robert Vaughn runs and knocks himself out on a tree. We cut back to the tribe. Robert Vaughn's dad, the symbol maker, he wakes up. He's now cured of his bear attack, and he learns that the son has broken the law. So that's not great. And then we cut back to Robert Vaughn. He's got no spear. I didn't catch how he lost his spear, but that's okay. He just decides to invent projectile weaponry with a bow and arrow, with the tiniest, flimsiest bow and arrow. I mean, it's like about 12 centimeters long. And he has to hold it like with his thumb and finger to hunt things. But some of it, he uses it to kill a deer, which he's going to take back to the tribe. That's his successful hunt. Then randomly, some wild dogs chase him. But thankfully, his dad has kind of run off. He's decided to break the law on behalf of his son to go and rescue him. And he arrives just in the nick of time to save Robert Vaughn from the dogs. But the bad beardy guy has followed them, I think, and he is very much on the side that Robert Vaughn has broken the laws. He has to be killed. They go for a bit of a fight, but it gets broken up by the wise men in the tribe, and they kind of have a truce. And then Robert Vaughn's blonde friend, not the one that died in the quicksand, but an actual woman, she goes off for a swim. Mm-hmm. And in a very 50s style, Robert Vaughn just happens to be walking along while she's bathing nude and plays her a little tune on his homemade panpipes, which he's also just invented.
And it's so badly played too, which I guess it would be if it was, you know, just invented. But
he just
still.
Invented it, Kim. Give him a break.
I know. Well, I mean, just come on. It was like a grade one student playing the recorder is what it sounded like.
Yeah, it was three blind mice played badly. But you know, she really digs this, and that's great. They kind of bond, and I think is it at this point? No, it's not at this point. It's later on. They go back to the kind of tribal cave, and the beardy guy's been warning about how the beast that can kill you without touching you, which is one of the other things that the law talks about is as being over the other side of the river, the kind of mosquito and a bog beast baby. That's what they're all worried about, and they think that it's going to come and kill them because they broke the law by going over the river. And the beardy guy's always going on about how they have to kill Robert Vaughn so that this beast doesn't come and kill them all first. And then out of nowhere, another kind of beast appears, and it's a bit confused at first, but it turns out it's just a guy on a horse. And the beardy guy wants to have him killed straight away, you know, very Zap Brannigan style. Ever since we lived in caves, man has had a dream that if he meets somebody with different ideas, we could kill him so we don't have to learn his strange and weird ideas. That's basically the beardy guy.
They also didn't know what the horse was, though. They called it a monster, too.
No, they didn't know what the horse was. They'd never seen that before.
Yeah.
And immediately they kill him. And there's quite a nice bit where just as the guy is about to get stabbed to death, he has time to say, peace, as he's getting kind of speared. Yeah. So this other guy obviously speaks English as well, which is quite interesting. I mean, it's a terrible film, obviously. I mean, obviously it's a terrible film, but there are some kind of quite cool touches that better writers and directors could have done more with. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so now Robert Vaughn has to have his kind of adult initiation ceremony, which just involves, I think, a lot of talking. I mean, it's just... Oh, no, he meets a sacred meteorite as well.
Yeah, they say they're going to show him all of the sacred objects, and they show him one, and then that's it.
They've got one sacred object, and it's a meteorite, and it's never referred to either before or after at that point.
Yeah.
But now he's a man, Robert Vaughn and the evil beardy guy kind of trade threats about how they're going to kill each other, and it's all very serious. But Robert Vaughn's blonde female friend wants to elope with him and go somewhere else away from the tribe. And so weirdly, Robert Vaughn decides to dig his own cave in the side of the hill. Yeah. He just digs his own cave. I mean, yeah, credit. That's great. So then they have some kind of quite romantic moments in their new cave. But Robert Vaughn, he's a rebel. He's a teenager. He's a caveman. He has to go his own way and do his own thing and not be kind of told what to do by the man. So he goes off to break the law again, knowing that that will not endear himself to the beardy villain. And his dad kind of follows him. And the beardy guy kind of gets the clan all up in arms saying, yeah, we've got to go and kill everyone so that they don't kill us. And we see very quickly that the beardy guy was very capable of crossing the river. There was nothing wrong with his leg that would have stopped that. He was just trying to entrap Robert Vaughn, I think. The dogs appear again. The weird beast appears again. The dogs attack. The beardy guy runs off because he's a coward. But Robert Vaughn confronts the beast. Everyone's telling him he should kill it, but he approaches it calmly. He kind of puts down his weapons and kind of walks towards it. But while this is happening, the beardy guy has gone up a tree with a giant polystyrene rock, which he then throws at the beast and kills it. And then, despite being further away than Robert Vaughn, he just drops dead in the tree. Is that what happens?
No. He arrowed him.
He shot him with the bow and arrow.
Oh, Robert Vaughn killed him. Ah, yeah. Okay.
In the most unemotional, blasé way, like he does everything else, he watches the guy drop the rock on him, and he's just like, boop.
And then,
Yeah.
That's it.
All right. So that's how it happened. That makes sense. I was thinking that with the explanation we get in a minute about why the beast kills without touching, I thought he'd done that to the beardy guy, but no. Anyway.
Right.
So Robert Vaughn gets close to the beast and sees it. Actually, it's just a guy in a costume. I mean, we could have told him that. but he has a book on him. And this is where things get like really kind of twisty turny, M. Night Shyamalan style. We get a kind of voiceover of the old man saying how he had witnessed the atomic wars, and this his kind of beast outfit was his anti-radiation suit. And the tribespeople were scared of him because he was so radioactive that he would give them radiation sickness and kill them. The laws that these guys have and are crazy about are all the taboos that they set up to protect the survivors. He has lived like much longer than natural lifespan thanks to all the radioactivity he's absorbed.
Yeah.
Which and this is all in a
yeah, this is all in a book as well. And then we have the voiceover at the end, which is kind of classic 50s, you know, dangers of atomic warfare. Don't do it. This has all happened before. Will it happen again? The end. Ominous. I mean, it's the kind of film that Futurama takes the piss out of all the time.
Yes, rightfully so.
And I think that, I don't know how popular, like, this film wasn't regarded as a good film at any point in history, but I feel like a lot of films must be inspired by it. Because you mentioned M. Night Shyamalan, and this story is very much like The Village from 2004, yeah, where...
totally.
Spoiler alert for The Village as well. But you think that it's in the past, but it's actually in the present in that one. And they have... they have this this religion or mythology built up where the elders are have this scary story about monsters to prevent people from leaving the community and finding out the truth. Also parallels to Battlefield Earth, I thought, because we have a post-apocalyptic future where humans are living like cave people, more or less.
And Planet of the Apes.
Planet of the Apes, yeah. So we have lots of movies that, if they weren't directly inspired by this one, they must be inspired by the same ideas that inspired this one, right? Well, this is going to be a tricky movie to review in our normal sense, because this twist ending kind of nullifies any inaccuracies we might have. He's got a metal spear. No, it's fine. He's got a metal spear because it's actually the future, right? they're not actually cave people. They're future people who just live in a collapsed civilization. So I guess we can review it spiritually, in the sense that we're supposed to think they're cave people, and that people in the 1950s would have seen this as what cave people looked like. So we've got our obvious bingo tropes, like cave people living with dinosaurs. Of course, that doesn't make any sense in the context of the movie either, because they're supposed to be like mutated animals, but that's not what mutation would do to animals in an irradiated zone.
But they said that they're like, and the animals mutated to look like dinosaurs for some reason, is what they said in the narration. So I think they were just like, we didn't know what else to do.
It does at least make more sense than, cave people living with actual dinosaurs.
Yeah, it does. Maybe we could draw a parallel there to Chernobyl, because we do have this natural radiation experiment in Chernobyl, and there's been lots of stories about the wolves in Chernobyl, which seem to be thriving, and they do have mutations, but the mutations aren't from the radiation. The mutations are from natural selection to help them survive the radiation better, right? And they just look like wolves. It's not like they're turning into monsters.
Yeah, I mean, being exposed to radiation may have increased the number of mutations they have.
Yeah,
but the selection force that's acting on them is just to help them survive amongst the radiation.
Yeah,
but maybe in 100 years they'll be like wolf dinosaurs.
Wolf dinosaurs.
Yeah, hybrids. Yeah.
We have during the opening credits, we have cave paintings, as we happen to see in a lot of movies. It seems like they like to put the credits over top of cave paintings. And I don't know if there's anything particular we can say about those cave paintings, but they seem to be like a real mishmash of different styles, because there were sort of human figurines that kind of looked Mesolithic. There were like linguistic symbols that were like clearly, I don't know if they were actually from a real alphabet, but I wasn't sure. And then there's like geometric shapes and hand impressions, and it's like a real mix of different cave paintings from like 50,000 years mashed together.
Foreshadowing. I mean, again, it's in
I guess so, yeah.
In a better film, that's what you would think of. Here, I'm not so sure.
Another bingo I've got written down is that the Stone Age is literally the Stone Age, the place where they live. I mean, there are jungles in this movie, but the place where they actually live is just rocky caves with not a lot of vegetation there.
But that's one of the plot lines, is that the teenager doesn't know why they're stuck at this rocky place with no food.
Yeah.
Right.
There's also kind of weird distinction between the older members of the tribe, who all have classic cave people hair, like frizzy, uncombed, just a bit kind of disheveled looking, versus the teenage cave people, who are all kind of glammed up, brill creamed. you could smell the Old Spice coming through the screen. Yeah.
And no nudity. Bra was crazy.
Yeah, it's so 50s. Like, they don't need metal spear points or flint projectiles. Just the bra underwiring that she has would take somebody's eye out, no problem.
Jeez. Yeah.
Another thing is that the symbol maker, the father of the teenage caveman, is wearing this fuzzy sheepskin kind of looking fur. Uh-huh. But I read that it's actually just a piece of carpeting.
I mean, it's good enough for Game of Thrones. That's what they did with all the Night Watch outfits. They were just IKEA wolf rugs.
Really?
Yeah. Mm. They just got them from IKEA and then sort of dressed them on the set. So, yeah.
That's crazy.
Mm. I didn't watch very much of that. I didn't like Game of Thrones.
Oh, dear. Too scary?
Let's not get into Game of Thrones. I feel so confused that it was popular because, like, oh, you just kill off your main characters constantly. Like, sure, that's surprising because it's a bad idea for a series.
I know.
You know? But— and, like, I don't know. It just felt like if I want to see boobs, I have the internet. I don't need to watch a terrible... It felt so uncreative because it's like, oh, the whatever the wall is, like Hadrian's Wall. It's like, it's just... Oh, you're just sort of like rehashing European history and mashing it all together. It seemed, and then like the bad guys were like the dark skinned people from the desert. It just felt so icky.
No, it all changes. The bad guys aren't the bad guys.
Yeah, the bad guys were the kind of, mostly the very pale skinned guys that lived. That lived in the capital. Anyway,
I don't know. You don't get that vibe for the first whole season.
No, but that's the thing, is
pretty
it
much
all
presenting
changes.
Those desert people as pretty savage.
Because you don't know them yet. It's all going to change. Yeah.
I have to watch two seasons of a show to find out that it's not racist. I don't know.
Oh, I didn't say that. I mean, certainly there are things later on that give the ick. But it's got dragons and magic. That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, there weren't any dragons in the first 1.5 seasons that I saw, so...
It takes forever for the dragons to get there, that's true.
It does take forever.
Like, I think that if a show takes multiple seasons to get good, like, you know, everybody, that's like a trope, it's like, oh, you have to stick with it so that it can get good.
Gets
like,
good.
Oh, why would I stick with
season?
A bad show?
Yeah, but I mean, like, Parks and Rec, I took me years to watch, like, The Office or Parks and Rec because I watched a couple episodes and didn't get it. And then someone made me watch more, and then now I love them.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll review Game of Thrones sometime.
Yeah. I'm just trying to think.
I don't know if there is anything in it.
Obsidian daggers are a big part of the later series. Clearly napped, anyway.
Starbucks coffee cups, too, I heard.
Yes. well, it goes with the IKEA rugs that they're wearing, so why not?
Well, back to our movie at hand,
right,
here.
Yes,
I quite like Robert Vaughn in this. I mean, I know him as the Man from U.N.C.L.E. He's quite a famous actor, and the Man from U.N.C.L.E. is a series that kind of they put on reruns, like on Sunday morning for kids when I was young in the dim and distant past. So yeah, it was quite interesting to see him as a young 35-year-old teenager in this.
I know that name, but I haven't actually seen it. What's it about?
So the Man from U.N.C.L.E. is just like a sort of a very 60s spy caper kind of series. But the kind of trope is that it teams up Robert Vaughn's American character with a Russian character. And this is, in the middle of the Cold War. So they have to work together against the kind of common enemy. So a bit like that, what was that Arnie film where Arnie's a, a Soviet kind of military officer, and they team him up with a decadent Western spy.
Danny DeVito?
Making that. No, that twins. It's not that one. I'll quickly Google it to see if I can find what's going on.
I just had to Google the Game of Thrones Starbucks cup because I'd never heard about that. That's crazy. Like how much money goes into it and that's the habit?
Yeah, Red Heat is the one I'm thinking of. It's him and Jim Belushi. So Jim Belushi is a Chicago police detective and Arnie is Soviet policeman Ivan Danko. So it's that kind of vibe. They remade it recently in a film with Henry Cavill and Armie Hammer, I think, which was quite good as well. Yeah. Anyway, that's where I know him from. So it was quite fun to see him in that.
You know, it's a good movie we watched when we just keep talking about other movies.
Well, that's it, because we're kind of stuck. We don't have any kind of tropes that we can kind of criticize, because they pulled the rug from under us by their kind of final act twist that, surprise, yeah. it's
in
the future. And
so inaccuracies. If any nerds are watching this in the future, you can't get mad at us.
But I did find out a few cool things about Robert Vaughn from doing a bit of a deep dive on his biography. Number one is that he is a distant cousin of Sidney Sweeney.
And who's is that? Sidney Sweeney?
You tell us, Josh. Who is Sidney Sweeney?
I don't know who Sidney Sweeney is. I'm actually asking.
Sidney Sweeney is a very charismatic young actress who has been in lots of things that I've never seen.
Is she naked in those things? Is that why you guys are being cagey?
I know. She's in.
I've not seen her in anything. I don't know who Sidney Sweeney is.
I mean, this sounds like a very bad, a very unbelievable excuse, but I haven't seen her in anything. But she's like one of those actresses that is just in the kind of zeitgeist at the moment. I've seen her on SNL. No, she's very good on that.
She's in White Lotus. Young modern actress is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Handmaid's Tale, White Lotus.
Euphoria, is that what she's in?
Yes,
I think it's Euphoria. Which I've not seen.
She's beautiful.
Yeah. Anyway, she's related to Robert Vaughn. And the other cool thing that I find out, I mean, if you go and look at the kind of Wikipedia articles on any actor who was big in the 40s or 50s, they always have like some really incredible links and like scandals that have just sort of been forgotten about. But with Robert Vaughn, the one that kind of stood out to me was that Matthew Vaughn, the director and screenwriter who's responsible for Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, Snatch, Layer Cake, The Kingsman, all those kind of British films.
Mm-hmm.
He's called Vaughn because he thought that Robert Vaughn was his dad.
Oh.
But it turns out he's not his dad. It's some other guy. And so his mother only admitted this to him after he did a paternity test and found out that Robert Vaughn wasn't his dad. It was some minor aristocrat. That was pretty freaky.
Crazy. That's like a sitcom trope where like the mom says that the missing dad is someone famous, right?
Yeah, like Mamma Mia or something.
Yeah.
There's something that this movie made me think of, and that is the problem of how to communicate nuclear waste dumps to the future. Are you familiar with this problem that they have spent some time trying to deal with? Wikipedia has a whole page called Long-Term Nuclear Waste Warning Messages. And the problem is that these are for nuclear waste dumps, and the movie is from a nuclear explosion. I'm sure it's a similar problem. The problem with nuclear waste dumps is that they're going to be radioactive for longer than probably a civilization will last, and certainly for longer than a language itself will last, because, you know, 500 years ago, English was quite different from the way we speak it today, and like 800 years ago, it's essentially a completely different language. And these nuclear waste dumps are going to be radioactive for thousands of years. So you can't just put up a sign, because in 1,000 years, nobody's going to be able to read that sign anymore, right? And we can't trust that somebody is going to be able to sort of upkeep the signs because, you know, civilization might fall. We can't count on American civilization existing
really?
For 800 years.
But it's going so strong.
Possibly 8 years.
Yeah.
So the Wikipedia has this page about like all the different ideas they've had for communicating this. And one thing that a lot of them have in common is turning it into a religion or a mythology, mm-hmm. Because that's the way things will get passed down. And it was, what was his name is Thomas Sebeok. And I remember studying him in some of my linguistics courses. I think he was, describes him as a linguist. And he suggested creating an atomic priesthood where you'd have this class of people who are like a religious clergy who are tasked with keeping the tradition of the atomic waste sites alive and passing it down for generations.
I mean, that's also a Planet of the Apes film, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And when were they doing that? It doesn't have a date on it for on Wikipedia here, so I'm not exactly sure if Planet of the Apes was inspired by that or if that happened later. But there's a whole bunch of other ideas, and a lot of them have to do with, you know, turning it into folklore or religion. One of the craziest ones, and the podcast 99% Invisible did an episode on it. They wanted to breed radiation cats or ray cats.
Yeah, I've heard of this.
And these cats, they would, I don't know how they would breed them or genetically engineer them so that they would change color when they're exposed to radiation. And basically, we would just breed these cats, and the idea is that cats are ubiquitous, whether they're pets or whether they're just feral and they follow around humans, they're just part of our society. So if you breed enough cats, this gene will just enter the cat gene pool. And then in the future, no one will remember that we've bred these cats, but the cats will change color. And so all you need to do is create a mythology surrounding if the cats change color, you're in a dangerous area. And then, I think it was with 99% Invisible, they commissioned a song so that we have this earworm song, which will be passed down the generations, warning about the dangers of ray cats.
If the cat turns red, you might be dead.
Yeah.
Oh, geez.
So I actually thought that was pretty cool in this movie, how it's a religion for them. It's become a religion, and probably, I don't know whether it started off at, like, these laws started off as like rules written by people who knew what the radiation was. And again, had the same idea of intentionally turning this into religion because we don't have the technology anymore to do something about this, but we do have the human instinct for mythology to just create a mythology that will keep people safe and say, don't go past the river because the land will turn your skin red.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that also reminds me of a Twilight Zone story that I read, I think called The Old Man. I can't remember the author, but similar idea. It's a kind of primitive culture. You're not told when it's set, but it feels kind of early medieval. And the people are angry because they have to obey all the rules that the old man tells them, like when to plant stuff and where it's safe to do it. And they also have a sort of teenage rebel who decides to storm the castle where the old man lives to sort of oust him. They treat him as a tyrant or a dictator. And the end of the story is that they break in and it's a computer. They're living in a kind of post-apocalyptic world, and the old man is a computer that is working out where it's safe to live, where the radioactive clouds are not, and where they can plant their food that they need to survive. And so it's quite a bleak ending because they destroy the computer, and so they've essentially destroyed themselves by getting rid of this last bit of technology that was keeping them safe.
Sounds very humans.
Futurama, Planet of the Amazon Women.
Exactly. Yeah, same idea with the femputer.
Except in that, it wasn't actually a femputer. It was just a fembot behind the scenes running the femputer.
A fembot
like
in a man
Wizard
bot's world.
One thing that I thought was funny in this movie is that they don't speak in a grunt language. They speak in English, but they do a thing that I feel like we've kind of seen in ways before, where they use roundabout ways of saying things as if they hadn't invented the word for that thing yet. So yeah. I have just a list of weird language here, and I'm going to say these things and see if you can remember what these things were in this movie. They say, make the symbols. That one's pretty straightforward. Basically, that's draw. When they draw their or paint their symbols on the wall. The sinking earth.
Quicksand.
Quicksand. The furry beast.
The furry beast?
That's the bear.
The bear.
Oh, right.
You know, they don't have a word for bear, but they have to call it the furry beast.
Well, they don't name each other either.
Yeah,
no, true. They don't have, that's, I also have that on the list here. They don't have names.
Yeah.
Give voice.
Yes.
Speak.
Speak. Give yeah. death.
Shoot. Cool. Yeah.
Like, isn't it silly that they don't have just these words for you know? It's not entirely verbs. They're missing a few nouns, but a lot of these are verbs, like give voice, give death, just like speak, kill. Just have an extra verb for that. Last one is throwing stick.
Uh-huh.
For their spears. I'm sure there were more than that, but it's one of these weird arbitrary things where, like, is it that we think these people are so primitive that they have only recently invented language, so they haven't filled out all their words yet, or what?
I think so. I think that's what they're getting at, but that's also doesn't align with the story, right? So they would have had to forget everything and then start talking like that. But it made it, like, they're trying to be a bit poetic too, I think, in that, like, Shakespearean caveman way. But then it also ended up being, when they gave speeches, it sounded like a child at a really bad play trying to, like, do his best to be Charlie Brown. And then the sun came up from the sky, right? Like,
the burning flame.
The burning flame.
They don't have a word for sun.
Yeah. Yeah, the burning flame.
It also, I think, reflects 50s culture. So it seems that in a lot of these cases, the languages that they use are meant to sound like pigeon, with the idea that they think that pigeon is primitive. Because people speak it in foreign countries. But pigeon's definitely not primitive. I mean, it doesn't have lots of verbs, but the way it uses the verbs it has is very, very interesting, very complex. And it's a really kind of, if you have people who speak different languages put together who have to get along, then when you get pigeons and creoles and things like this, the language that comes out of it, it's incredible, really, how they've managed to make themselves understood using just a few verbs and lots of nouns. So, I mean, that's what I take away from it, is that they're trying to, the kind of institutional racism of the times is kind of even bleeding through into how they think about languages and what they would class as primitive, in inverted commas, versus complex language.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And like, pidgin and Creole languages really show how instinctive language is to humans, because if you take two groups of people with different languages and put them together, they're going to sort out, a pidgin language, which, you know, doesn't have a complete grammar at first, but children have such an instinct for language that it's the children that will turn that into a full-fledged language with a complete grammar within one generation, right? Mm-hmm. So if you have, you know, a bunch of adults, you put them together, they'll create a pidgin language, but then if they live together in that group long enough and have children, those children will take that pidgin language and sort of instinctively construct a grammar around it. So you can end up with, you know, it's a mix of nouns and verbs from different languages, but it has its own unique grammar, which emerges sort of organically out of it by having children speak it.
Yeah.
Which, again, is that just shows how natural language is to humans, that it's so instinctive that I think we still believe in that critical period of language before, like, 12 years old, where if you don't acquire your language skills before then, like we have the case of feral children or
like
child abuse,
Genie.
Where children were not Genie, who was strapped to a potty in an attic for the first 12 years of her life.
And not allowed to make noise.
Yeah, not allowed to make noise. So if you don't get exposed to language in that critical period, you will really struggle to get language for the rest of your life. But the flip side of that is if you put a bunch of children together, without a complete language, they will create their own complete language automatically. So yeah, the idea of this language being so primitive, like there really is no such thing as a primitive language. It's one of the things that's hard to study in paleoanthropology because, you know, to go from a bunch of nouns and verbs to a complete language, there's like a leap there. You're basically going from something finite to something infinite in the way that you can, you know, the possibilities for constructing it. And I think we still don't really have any idea where or when or how that leap happened in humans to create this sort of language instinct that we have. Although I haven't really studied that since my undergrad.
I think if we deconstruct language, like the phonemes and trace it, it looks like it probably started in South Africa at the emergence of us, right? But don't know for sure.
South Africa with modern humans or South Africa with a more distant...
Modern humans.
So that's just the sort of common origin of modern human languages.
Yeah.
But, you know, did Neanderthals or Denisovans or anybody else who was outside of Africa at the time, did they, you know, did that... If we can trace our modern human languages to South Africa, was there a deeper language before that that might have spread or... Might have emerged independently in other humans at the same time. And so maybe Neanderthals had a language that would be, you know, very, very different from ours, having diverged so much sooner.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably, but I don't think we're ever going to have the evidence for that unless you build a time machine and then get back to the present to tell us.
One last little thing in my notes I have here is more title confusion for this movie, which we have a lot of the time. This movie was released under the name Teenage Caveman, but in the UK, it was released as Out of the Darkness.
Really?
Well, that's a crap better title.
We've seen titles like that in other places. We watched a movie called Out of Darkness, which is a pretty recent movie. And when I was searching for that one, I kept finding another movie called Out of the Darkness, which had nothing to do with cave people.
Right.
So that's a title that... has been used several times, but this movie was filmed under the working title Prehistoric World. And apparently Roger Corman said that he didn't like the name Teenage Caveman. And in an interview later in his life, he said, I never directed a movie called Teenage Caveman.
It should have been called something like, they should have had a name more for the thing that kills you without touching, right? It should have like been a concise name that's like two or three words that gives that same idea, and that should have been the name for it. Because that's the unique part of this story, right?
Yeah, I think that the concept of this movie, like we keep talking about it, the twist, if you didn't know it going in, comes as a surprise. It's not a bad twist. It is a pretty cool concept. The movie was really low budget, and that's one of the major problems with it. So, like, it could have been a really cool movie. It probably still could be a really cool movie if you wanted to remake it. Not if you remade it and didn't have the twist, because then it just has nothing to do with cavemen. So,
yeah. And also, if you put the twist in the tagline to the film on the poster, that doesn't work either.
Yeah.
Well, it's almost a 70-year-old movie. I guess we don't have to be too careful about spoilers for such old movies.
Someone's like, I was going to get around to watching that.
Has this one been on Mystery Science Theater? Because it seems like it would be a good...
It has, in fact. I didn't watch the Mystery Science Theater version, but I believe it was on in 1991.
Okay.
Episode 315? That's from memory. I don't know if that's correct. Well, I think we're at the end of our notes here. We don't have a lot to say about this one. Little light on archaeology or paleoanthropology content because it happens to be in the future. So, I knew that going into this one. I wanted to do this movie. I wasn't sure how much content we would get out of it. But we can say that we covered this one now, at least.
Yeah. It's terrible, but it's terrible in a fun way.
And it was short, thank goodness.
And it was short, yeah. That's always a plus.
Do you have questions, comments, or movie requests? We want to hear from you. Find us on Blue Sky and Facebook at SOTSA Podcast. Send us an email to screensofthestoneage@gmail.com or visit our website at screensofthestoneage.com.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.